Good Monday. This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, January 4th, 2021. This is 91.3 KUAF, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. I'm Kyle Kellums. Here's hoping your holidays have been what you wanted and needed. Thank you for spending time with us today. Ahead on our show, what a late-year congressional package means for thousands of Pacific Islanders and Marshallese living in Arkansas. And in our second half hour, we welcome back Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History for a new year of tours through the state's past. This week, food. And after this Ozarks at Large on Here and Now, Sir David Attenborough's new nature series looks at the factors that make Earth a perfect planet for life. We'll hear about his series and his call for action on climate change. Sir David Attenborough and the latest news beginning at 1 on Here and Now today on 91.3 KUAF. More than 1,200 Arkansas hospital beds have COVID-19 patients as this new year begins. That's a record for the state during the pandemic. Sunday's new cases totaled more than 2,000, and Arkansas's confirmed and probable deaths from the virus now number more than 3,700 people. Governor Asa Hutchinson tweeted yesterday that the new cases almost always lead to increased hospitalizations, which he notes affects anyone needing treatment in a hospital, not just those with COVID-19. The governor's next update on the virus in Arkansas is scheduled for tomorrow afternoon. The University of Arkansas and the Arkansas Department of Health will host a drive-through testing clinic on campus this week from Wednesday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. each day. Drive-up testing for COVID-19 will be available in the parking lot across from Baum Walker Stadium at the corner of South Razorback Road and West 15th Street. The tests are available for university students, faculty, and staff, and will require no out-of-pocket costs, though faculty and staff should bring insurance card and university ID. No surprise, the pandemic tops the list of the most important Arkansas political stories of the year in the annual survey from Talk Business and Politics. The list cites the various opinions toward mandates, businesses, and more regarding the virus as the biggest story with political overtones in 2020 for the state. Protests for justice reform placed second on the list, followed by the increased move to the right of the state's electorate, the potential candidates for governor in 2022, and voter acceptance of a highway tax while rejecting a proposed change to how the state constitution is amended. The full list, as well as a list of the top business stories according to the publication, can be found at talkbusiness.net. This is Ozarks at Large. Buried in the $900 billion bipartisan COVID-19 relief measure passed by Congress in late December is restoration of Medicaid health benefits to legally residing Pacific Islanders, including thousands of Marshallese in Arkansas. Medicaid was first conveyed in 1986 under a compact of free association, then nullified a decade later by welfare reform. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the entitlement comes after thousands of Marshallese in Northwest Arkansas have been gravely impacted by COVID-19.
Dr. Sheldon Ricklin, a Marshallese native, moved his practice from Hawaii to Northwest Arkansas several years ago to treat Pacific Islander migrants who in Arkansas are a majority Marshallese. Ricklin divides his time between Community Clinic in Springdale, which charges a sliding scale fee, and here at North Street Clinic inside University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences in Fayetteville, where Ricklin, an assistant professor, also teaches and conducts research.
We're fortunate enough that, you know, in certain places like here in Northwest Arkansas, You know, UAMS has that North Street Clinic that, you know, that provides free health care to our Marshallese diabetic and hypertensive patients in Northwest Arkansas, that utilizes the expertise of our students along with the faculty members and our Marshallese, you know, community health workers. So, you know, it's we're fortunate to have these institutions to kind of at least have some access for them. But again, you know, when it comes to specialized care, for many that needs to be on dialysis, or those who need cancer care, and we need to send them elsewhere, that's where the conundrum comes into play.
Marshallese and intact indigenous culture suffer disproportionately from chronic disease stemming from centuries of disruptive foreign occupation and high rates of cancer, in part tracing back to mid-20th century Cold War U.S. nuclear weapons testing on their island archipelago. And now Ozark Islanders are reckoning with a global pandemic, says Ricklin.
It's been quite heart-wrenching. You know, it's to see many of the members of the community being impacted. Speaking with them and talking with them and trying to make sure they're needs are addressed.
Marshallese share multi-generational family quarters, adhering to communal traditions, but early on unwittingly sharing the coronavirus. Since March, over 3,100 Marshallese tested positive for COVID-19. A quarter of the entire Arkansas population, 52, have died.
Very tragic. You know, we know many people have passed on, including people that are very close to many of us.
Marshallese community activists, medical experts, including CDC, which conducted a site visit last summer, as well as the state of Arkansas, have stepped up to provide critical PPE and educate Marshallese about COVID risks and when to seek medical care.
Unless they're really sick, then they will go to urgent centers and many a times to the emergency rooms. They go to the hospitals. And as we all know, as you go to these hospitals or emergency rooms, the bills are very high and very costly for the patients and also for the healthcare systems as well.
Marshallese are migrating to the southern U.S. to take low-wage jobs in the meatpacking industry, now considered essential workers. But many decline workplace insurance as well as marketplace insurance, using income for food and rent. And although legally present in the U.S., Marshallese lacked access to Medicaid, which was stripped by Congress from them 25 years ago to save federal dollars. U.S. Senator Mazie Hirono, a Democrat from Hawaii, has pushed for Medicaid reinstatement for compact migrants since 2013, including filing key legislation a few months prior to the global pandemic being declared.
And it's part of our compacts to make sure that when they do come to our country, that they are afforded the kinds of protections that they should have. And that is why this elimination of their eligibility for Medicaid was such an egregious error.
Working with lawmakers, Hirono finally managed to amend the 1996 welfare law known as the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, restoring Medicaid to compact migrants. The bipartisan omnibus appropriations bill was approved by Congress December 21st. That means citizens from the Federated States of Micronesia, the Republic of the Marshall Islands, and the Republic of Palau can now apply for Medicaid.
And while they represent only 4% of our population, they represent 25% of our COVID cases.
A lot of our people are sick.
That's Eldon Alec, Consul General of the Republic of the Marshall Islands.
So a lot of Marshallese are coming to the States, you know, to try to, you know, prolong their life, trying to seek medical care. And very fortunate that the U.S. government has now reinstated our Medicaid. Because, you know, we don't want any more people to die. And like you said, you know, all the sacrifices we've done, you know, I feel that we've always been so faithful to the U.S. We've in the United Nations, the record shows that we are always on the U.S. side. As though we're one of the countries that always 100% voted with the United States. You know, we welcome Americans into our land. We've always considered the United States as our closest friend.
Melissa Leilon, founder and executive director of Arkansas Coalition of Marshallese, has long pressed to reinstate the entitlement and was stunned when it passed, she says.
It was kind of like a moment of silence, almost like a funeral, because we've lost so many people. We are estimating that there is about one in every three Marshall Islanders that do not have insurance coverage. And that's the data that we have collected throughout the years of our work within the community and enrolling families into the marketplace.
Islanders in Arkansas will also be able to apply for expanded Medicaid, known as Arkansas Works. The annual cost of Medicaid for treating migrants, Hirono says, is around $60 million, with states where Pacific Islander communities are concentrated, providing a cost share. At a recent coronavirus press briefing, we queried Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson about the restored benefit.
Well, I am delighted that the Marshallese population in Arkansas will now be covered under the new federal law for Medicaid. This is coverage that it made no sense that they were denied that coverage, and we have a responsibility to them as well as to our other citizens. But it was a glitch in the law that has finally been remedied. It's something I have advocated for. This will mean a lot in terms of their improved access to health care among that population that has really been hit hard by COVID.
When COVID-19 infection first gripped the nation last spring and summer, a UAMS study found that cases among Marshallese in Arkansas were 400% higher than the general population, causing what one medical leader described as a tidal wave of suffering. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
And still to come on this first Monday of 2021 edition of Ozarks at Large, Antoinette Grajeda explains how a combined effort between the Museum of Native American History and Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, both in Bentonville, is bringing a new mural to town. That's explained just ahead on this edition of Ozarks at Large. Thank you, thank you, thank you to all of you who donated and contributed non-perishable items and non-perishable food to be put under the KUAF Giving Tree last month. Because of you, more than 1,500 pounds of food was contributed. Tricycle Farms picked it up and distributed it to their partners to help those who are battling hunger and food insecurity throughout our region. Tricycle Farms has estimated it's about $4,500 worth of food that they distributed. Thanks again to everyone who brought in food and made this Giving Tree a success. And one more time, also thank you to everyone who contributed during KUAF's on-air fundraiser in December. We met that goal as well. That means we continue to be strong and independent as your public radio station. You can find out more about us at KUAF.com. And don't forget, new year, but still, you can hear Ozarks at Large as a podcast on your schedule. We're available through all the major podcast distributors. And you can still sign up for free for the daily Ozarks at Large email newsletter. It comes to your email for free every Monday through Friday afternoon with a list of everything that was on that day's show and links so you can listen to those pieces and interviews and stories, as well as share them with friends through email and social media. You can sign up for the free, have I mentioned that yet? Free Ozarks at Large daily email newsletter at KUAF.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Museum of Native American History has commissioned a Muskogee artist to create a new Trail of Tears mural as part of a joint exhibition with Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art. The mural will be comprised of 3 4-foot by 8-foot panels, which Tulsa-based artist Johnny Diacon has started painting in his home studio. To learn more about the project, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda spoke with the artist, as well as Museum Director Charlotte Buchanan Yale, who says they're thrilled to be working with the artist.
One thing that we love about the museum is that we connect the 16,000-year history of the first people of all the Americas with present-day cultural leaders making news, art, and excitement today. And a lot of times, well, actually most of the times, these people will become part of our museum family. And that is Johnny and his wife, Nikki. I mean, they, have worked with us at a drop of a hat. And so when the project came up to do the joint exhibit with Crystal Bridges, Companion Species, We're All Related, I couldn't think of a better artist to spotlight because during COVID, we've had to build our virtual presence where we have virtual tours and incredible events. And, we really want to feature the good works of, you know, the indigenous community that's out there. And I thought, Johnny is the guy. And I thought, well, why not? Let's do something big and let's take one of the walls and create a mural. And Johnny submitted his design for the Trail of Tears mural. And we said, yes. And that is how I snagged Johnny.
Johnny, can you tell me a little bit about how you came up with the idea for your mural? It's not finished yet, and we're on radio, so you can't see it. So can you kind of describe what it will look like?
Yeah, I came up with the idea because, you know, my people got to Oklahoma because of the Indian Removal Act, Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Act. So, you know, everybody thinks of the Cherokees, you know, being removed, but there was a lot of tribes that were removed because of that. And so it's kind of a important piece of my who I am. You know, my people ended up here in Oklahoma. And so when I do these works, you know, I don't do too many Trail of Tears pieces. Because, you know, I am an artist and that's how I make my money, you know, my living. And I really don't like to depict the suffering like that and make money off of it, you know. But when I do these pieces, like for this mural, it's a commemorative piece, you know, to let people know that this is what happened, you know, and that we're still here and we're in the situation that we are because of this. And to us, you know, the Trail of Tears is almost like a Holocaust. You know, it's a memorial when we do these pieces. It's our ancestors, you know, our relatives, and it's an honor and a tribute to them. And so when I came up with this idea, I wanted to do, you know, the panels. I've got three large panels. They're about 4x8, you know, the three panels. But it'll be it'll be what you usually see on the Trail of Tears, you know, a line of people, you know, and I'm going to show different little aspects of what they had to go through on the trip over, you know, just to give a little glimpse. You know, it'll be kind of like a clip note version of this painting. I'm going to show a lot of little incidences that happen, you know, just kind of highlight it. You know, they may not all happen at once, but, you know, just give that little, so people, when they see it, they'll know this is what happened. That was my plan for the mural. And I've got a big enough area to work with. I can do a lot of, you know, the depiction that I want to get that across. And then the size of it, I think, will be, you know, I've done smaller ones and people have been touched by it. I think once they see it even bigger, it kind of draw them into it more. And that's my plan with the design on this, is to get people kind of that feeling that, you know, they're walking beside these people.
How did you get into art and painting to begin with? Is that something that you picked up from your family, or how did you become interested in that?
Well, my late father was a sign painter, an old school sign painter, did the hand lettering of signs. And he moved us to Arkansas years ago. He followed where the work was. So he moved us from Oklahoma to Northwest Arkansas, because Walmart was starting out and Tyson's and there was billboards because Beaver Lake had just started. And so there was a lot of billboard and sign work going on in that area because it was growing. So he moved us over there. And as a young child, you know, I just got interested in color and art design from him. Had poor eyesight, went to an eye doctor and got my glasses fixed or my eyes fixed. And I could see that this doctor was a collector of the old flat style Indian art. And that was my first experience where I could actually see, because I was legally blind without glasses. And I saw the artwork for the first time. I saw these images and it stuck in my head. And this is as a young boy. And so, you know, I was trying to replicate those images that I saw using my dad's sign paints and stuff. And then I helped, you know, as I was getting older, and I helped him with his sign business. And that's how I got interested in art, because he was doing a lot of art, and he nourished that interest. And then as I got older, I graduated high school and I was out for a few years, and I found out about Bacon College in Muskogee, and they had an Indian art program there. So I enrolled there, and that began my career, in art. And then I went to the Institute of American Indian Arts out in Santa Fe. And so I've been entering shows for the last 40 years and doing paintings. And that's how I got started. I trace the roots back to my dad, because he was a sign painter, but he was a graphic artist, and he was had a lot of background in these things that, just sparked my interest at a young age.
And how would you describe your style of work now?
Oh, gosh. I had one teacher say it was schizophrenic, because I go from the flat style to a more contemporary look. It just depends what I'm in the mood to do or what I'm depicting, how I want to depict that scene. Like with this recent COVID experience, I did some artist response pieces and the initial lockdown. I was in my studio with nothing to do after about a week of being worried about where it was going. I finally got the desire to create again. And so I did a piece that was more contemporary style, that was in relationship to COVID and older Native Americans. Because it was affecting our older people, our elders. And so I did a piece on that. And then as time going on, I thought, well, here's all these healthcare workers on, the front lines in Indian country, in the hospitals and stuff. So I did a flat style piece. And so, it was COVID related. So it was an old style of painting with a modern, situation. So I go back and forth. Like this mural, I thought about doing flat style. I thought, no, I'm going to do a different style. And so I got locked in on this more Western looking style of art. So I'm going to do this instead of the flat style. But yeah, it goes back and forth, and just depends what medium I'm using. Cause I do, I use oils, acrylics, anything I can do with 2D art, it just depends what the mood is and how that idea comes to me, how I do my art. And it's kind of hard to explain without actually seeing the images of what my art, because it's different styles. You can always tell it's mine because I got a certain style about my art, but you can always tell it's mine no matter which style I'm using.
So you have different styles of work. As a Native artist, do you face any challenges in terms of the expectation of what you're supposed to create? I've heard artists say that, as a Native artist, people expect them to only do Native art. So something like the Trail of Tears, but they are in fact an artist and they want to do other things that inspire them as well, not just their heritage. Is that something that you have dealt with in your career?
Yeah. And when I paint things, if I do like an everyday scene, it's usually, I paint from within my culture or who I am. So it may be a scene of people cooking, women cooking, or just everyday life. So it doesn't, sometimes it just doesn't look different than what you'd see someone else painting, but the subject matters and the people in it are usually Native, because that's what I'm painting. I think where I have a lot of people expect when they see Indian art, they want to see Plains Indians with the headdresses and on horses and buffalo hunts and things like that, which is not what my people did. So a lot of times when I produce work on my people in the Muskogee, we're Southeastern Indian. We've got different customs, different traditions, different attire when we perform ceremonies. So it may not look what a non-native that's familiar with our tribe thinks what an Indian piece should look like. So they may not recognize it right off as being what they think is Native American looking, but people in my tribe see it and they go, and they love it, because they recognize it right immediately what those images are, what they mean. So that's kind of one of the dilemmas I run into with non-natives. When I get into art markets, they may pass it over because they like it, but they can't relate to it because it's not what they think an Indian piece of work should look like. And like I said, you know, I paint just whatever I decide to paint. And so a lot of times it may not be a straight up ceremonial piece or something like that. It might just be everyday life, but the people in it are native because that's just where I'm coming from when I paint. And so, I've even done a painting of people sitting in an IHS waiting room, an Indian Health Service, you know, clinic waiting room, which is a bunch of Indians sitting in the waiting room, you know, and people look at it and go, well, this is Indian art. I don't get it. But Indians look at it and they say, oh, yeah, yeah, I've been in this clinic. And they recognize it right off, you know, but that to me, that's, you know, it's native art produced by a native person. People looking at me say, well, this isn't a buffalo hunt. What are these Indians doing sitting in this, you know, are these people doing sitting in, you know, this room? But yeah, it's definitely Indian art.
So have you come up with a title for the mural that you're working on presently? And when do you think it might be done?
I haven't came up with a title for it yet. I'll probably will come up with one. You know, probably I usually come up with titles after I get them done. And I'm hoping by the first part of the 2021, around January, I'll have them done because I'll have plenty of time to work on them. But once I get started, it shouldn't take long at all because I'll wake up in the middle of the night because I can't sleep and I'll work on 2 or 3 hours, you know, and I should be sleeping. I'll be working on it. So I'm hoping by January I'll have it done.
Well, something to look forward to in the new year. Charlotte, once it is done, where will it be installed at the museum?
We are excited. Our first mural went up a couple of years ago by J. Nicole Hatfield. And when you drive by the museum, it's three outstanding portraits. And the reason why I looked at Johnny, I mean, he's our spotlight artist, and you actually can see some of his prints on our online gift shop. It will be on the south side of the building, and it will be right below our great room where we have events, and it'll be on the parking lot side. And we will have it framed. So, you know, because he's taking the panels, we'll frame it, and it'll go up that way. And no matter what happens, this mural will be a moving piece of art. It'll always be put together. And again, it is absolutely my honor to feature the work of Johnny Diacon. Mr. Bogle that created the museum has Cherokee heritage. And we want to show all the other different tribes that were part of that removal and to never forget. So we are an official Trail of Tears stop. And so we did a presentation with the Arkansas Trail of Tears just recently, and that will always be part of our archives. But what has happened with Johnny is that they have now made us a national stop. So we're really excited, and it's such an honor because there's little street signs that say Trail of Tears, and you're like, well, where is it? Where is it? Because there's so many tributaries that people don't realize. And so this will be part of a national effort to draw people in. It makes us more available to tell the story and to feature it.
That was Charlotte Buchanan Yale, director of the Museum of Native American History, and Tulsa-based artist Johnny Diacon. You can find photos of the work in progress on Johnny's social media pages. Just search for Johnny Diacon Art on Facebook or Instagram. He spells his last name D-I-A-C-O-N. And this is Ozarks at Large.
As the state's fastest growing region, quality healthcare professionals are essential. UAMS Northwest Regional Campus in Fayetteville is educating the future of healthcare. UAMS.info/future for information. When caring for a seriously ill loved one, the journey shouldn't be taken alone. Circle of Life Hospice can help. Services are covered by Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance. No one is turned away based on an inability to pay. 750-6632 or nwacircleoflife.com for more.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellens. With me on the phone is Randy Dixon. Randy is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Randy, Happy New Year. Welcome back to Ozarks at Large.
Happy New Year to you. It's great to be back, Kyle.
We'll set the
hope
stage.
You had a good holiday.
Yes, I did. And you too, I hope.
Yes.
Let's set the stage for what we do here before we get into this Monday's subject. You have access through the Pryor Center to archives that were originally on KATV, have been digitized, returned. They're being put up on the Pryor Center website. This is made possible through Barbara Tyson and the Tyson Family Foundation, and it spans all kinds of topics and times.
That's right. It's whatever the news happened to be, whatever the weather or sports, that's what's in there. And right now we have material from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and we're getting more and more material every week now, and we'll be adding it throughout this year. So there will be thousands and thousands of more hours in posted in 2021.
And sometimes we take a certain month in history, sometimes we take a person, and sometimes, like this session, we take a topic, and the topic, food.
Well, I thought after the holidays, we all ate a little bit too much, and I started thinking about food, so I started looking in, and, you know, most of what I found was in the 70s, and Kyle, I can't speak for you, but I'm glad I was a kid during the 70s, because with inflation and the war and all kinds of gas prices, and I just don't know as an adult how much fun that would have been. And that's kind of reflected in all of these, or most of these reports that I found on food and food production and food prices around the state.
We're going to start with Secretary of Agriculture, and I bet if I had a list in front of me of all the former secretaries of agriculture, only a few names, a very few, would resonate. This one does, not necessarily because of his what he did as secretary, but something later. We can go back into that. But this is Earl Butz. What is he talking about?
Well, he's talking about, you know, the inflation and the price of food. And, you know, he's being very realistic about it. He's not real optimistic, but this is 1973, and this is sort of his take on what's going to happen to your pocketbook when going to the grocery store.
For 3 months in a row now, farm prices have come down rather substantially. And I had looked back on page 13 for a little two-inch column about farm prices coming down. That wasn't news. They've come down rather substantially. Now the big rise in food prices is behind us. But if anybody thinks that we're going to have cheap food prices in this country in terms of what we had 3 or 4 years ago, he is mistaken. And I want to nail that down right now.
Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz in 1973, not mincing words at all. Of course, he was a controversial figure, and he was very blunt there, and he was a blunt person. He told, a very horrible off-color joke when he thought he wasn't being heard. It was reported by Rolling Stone magazine and others, and he eventually had to leave that post.
He did.
All right, you mentioned it wouldn't be fun to be an adult in the 70s because of the concerns about prices. Here comes somebody else who's going to reiterate that. Who are we about to hear from?
This is a state representative named Art Gibbons from North Little Rock, and his talks about possible legislation to keep grocery prices down and curb inflation.
I think this is one thing that that we need to point up. I think if a merchant buys a can of beans and he marks it 15 cents, he ought to be responsible enough to say, well, I can afford to sell that can of beans 2 weeks from now for 15 cents, and not for him to take advantage of restamping it 5 or 6 times while it's sitting on his shelf. And I'm sure this will be unpopular with some of the merchants, and it's not a question of a popularity contest. It's just a thing that I am getting more calls from my constituents on this one item, I think, than anything else: inflation and the dwindling of the average man's paycheck. And so this is just a step I'm taking to try to do something about it.
State Representative Art Gibbons, who represented part of North Little Rock, that was in 1974. We're talking about food this week with archives from the Pryor Center. I was a child in the mid-70s. I do not remember a rumored bread shortage, but apparently there was one.
Well, I didn't either, and came across this interview with an Arkansas businessman, owned a bunch of restaurants, George Cook. And there was a huge concern at the time, this was in 74, about wheat prices. And there were rampant rumors of a bread shortage and just not being able to find bread on the shelf, sort of like, I guess, a snow day or something that's permanent.
But I think we will have wheat, I think we'll have flour, and I think we will have bread throughout the balance of this year. I don't think it will be at a dollar a loaf. I think it'll be substantially higher, but I think we'll have it. And I don't think we'll have bread lines. I think they're exaggerating the problem. I think we have a problem, but it is not a catastrophic problem.
Some have blamed a supposed wheat shortage on the Russian grain deal. You believe that?
Yes, I do. I think the whole problem stems from the sale to the Russians.
That was from 1974. And what we know about food is one cost may affect another. I do remember jokes about the rising cost of meat, of beef, of hamburger, yes. Because Johnny Carson would make jokes about it. Here is...
Oh, he sure would.
Yeah, I mean, it was a monologue topic. What are we about to hear now?
Well, and that also kind of went hand in hand with wheat prices, grain prices. So it was costing beef producers more to raise their cattle. And this is a spokesman from Beef Producers Association about their struggles with inflation.
Well, the feed grains are still real high, and the conversion factor for the cattle, that is to put the grain into beef cattle, is about 41 to 43 cents a pound per pound of gain. So you can see if he's selling about 38, 39 cents, he's not doing too well. But the cattle that are coming out four long, the reason I say they have to go up because when those calves went to the lots, they were about 65 cents a pound. And if it's costing 41 cents for the gain, or better, and our cattle right now are about 40, 40 and a half cents. But that's just paying for the gain. We have to come up with to take care of his overhead. And a lot of his, that includes some overhead, but a lot of additional things, death, loss, and veterinarian fees and the cost of the cattle to begin with, and he's got to make a little profit too. So when we get them all together, well, we're going to be a little higher.
Okay, so we've heard about beef, we heard about grains and bread. What about poultry?
Well, the big one in Arkansas is poultry, as you well know. And this was a little different take that I came across, that it wasn't as much of grain prices or operating costs, but gas prices and the trucker strikes that were going on, independent truckers, that were causing a glitch in the entire poultry industry. And Steve Barnes, who was with KATV at the time, now with Arkansas PBS, had a report from Springdale about the problems with poultry.
If the predictions of poultry executives come to pass, then the independent truckers may have a public relations problem to face, along with the high cost of diesel and lower speed limits. Because shutting down the poultry industry in Arkansas is about the same as taking chickens from the nation's pots. Steve Barnes, KATV News, Springdale.
Nobody ever signed off a story better than Steve Barnes.
That's true. He made you believe it.
He did. And as you mentioned, he's still with Arkansas PBS, host of Arkansas Week every weekend. Okay, you mentioned poultry is the biggie for Arkansas. It is, but there's another huge food industry in the state.
Well, the biggest. And
yeah.
The largest rice producer and seller, in not just in the state or the country, but in the world, is based right in Stuttgart, Arkansas. And of course, it's Riceland Foods. And at the time, KETV had a farm service director was his title, and he did, you know, agriculture was so big. We had one reporter who all he did was agriculture. His name's John Philpott, and he's still around. I was able to interview him last year for the Pryor Center, but this is his report on Riceland Foods.
I've heard a number of times that Riceland Foods was the biggest organization of its type in the world. So to find out exactly what type that is, we asked the chairman of the board and chief executive officer of Riceland Foods, Mr. L.C. Carter.
Riceland Foods is a farmer-owned and farmer-controlled cooperative that receives and processes and markets the rice of some 25,000 rice and soybean farmers in eastern Arkansas, southeast Missouri, northeast Louisiana, and Mississippi.
And this is about what percentage of Arkansas's rice and soybeans?
We handle about 40% of the Arkansas soybean crop and a little over 50% of the rice crop.
What's your prospects for international sales this year?
Well, we think they are good. We are already making sales in the international market. We are particularly interested in moving rice into areas like the Middle East and in Western Europe and South Africa are some of our major dollar markets. Then during the year, we know we'll be making government concessional sales under PL 480 to Bangladesh, to South Korea, to many of the areas where we are sending food for humanitarian purposes.
Well, that brings us to the meeting you're having today of the membership.
Yes, we've had our 55th annual meeting today, and we had a good year, and we are looking forward to a good year next year. We're real happy that we were able to handle almost $500 million worth of agricultural products last year. We think our settlements to our members is quite satisfactory. They all seem happy. They're enjoying this barbecue, and it's a little warm, but we are enjoying this annual meeting today.
Well, it was a fine annual meeting, a real good barbecue at lunch, and Riceland Foods now has its work cut out for it in handling and marketing Arkansas's biggest rice and soybean crops. John Philpott, Cooperative Extension Service, reporting for News Scene 7.
Okay, now this next cut.
Yeah, I thought we'd kind of end a little more on a fun note rather than the gloom and doom of prices in the 70s.
Well, we've still got two more cuts, right?
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Okay. So, and they're both kind of fun. This first one is not of an Arkansan. It's of
right.
a very famous.
But he made regular trips to the States.
He did. He did. And I just find this a curious clip. Let's listen to it. Then I want to ask you some things about it. Okay. So this is Harlan Sanders, of course, Colonel Sanders from KFC.
I don't think there'd be as many new franchises as there was blossomed out here for the last couple of years because of the failures of them. But that was because so many people went into it, purely from a promotional idea. I don't see whether they could sell the stock or something of that way. They got used to use the name of some celebrity, and then they knew nothing about the business or needed the promoter. So consequently, the public just spent a lot of money for nothing and never did get a product.
You know, we mentioned at the top of this conversation that Earl Butz was very straightforward and sort of brusque. Colonel Sanders, just based on what we just heard, kind of sounds the same way to me.
Yes. You know, he was working on, franchises.
Yeah.
And he was in sort of a different position. But he was very dedicated to his franchisees, and he would come to visit quite a bit. But he had a good point that a lot of celebrities would decide they wanted to get in the restaurant business. I remember my very first job as a kid was at George Lindsay's Burger Palace. You know, he played Goober.
Yes. Yes.
And knew nothing about restaurants. It was open for about 3 months, and then I was out of a job at like 14. But Harlan Sanders knew his business. You know, he didn't even get into the restaurant business until he was in his 50s, I believe.
Yeah.
And he knew about chicken, and still, quite successful to this day, as we all know about KFC.
Well, you can still find many KFCs around the state. There was a time when you could find a Minuteman restaurant in several different towns in Arkansas, then a time when you couldn't find any. What do you remember about Minuteman?
Well, it was one of my favorite memories, that and the Shack barbecue. Mm. But Minuteman had their charcoal grilled burgers, but then they also had a microwave deep dish apple pie. That a microwave was a big deal back then, and they would they would zap those things. But they were big in Central South Arkansas and went away. They were owned by a man named Wes Hall, and he actually lived a couple of streets away from me growing up, and he, of course, had the biggest house in the neighborhood. We thought it was a mansion, but he had the chain of restaurants, and he just he had some kind of fun things to say about the business, and this is in 1974.
Well, the biggest stumbling block in any service industry is to get the people that are working with you to believe that in the same principles that you do. And this is a matter of constant training. And we have one man that doesn't do anything but hire and train the Minuteman way. That's all he does. We're famous for having the most distant carryout order that's ever been delivered. And the first one we delivered to India. We got a letter from a young man in India that wanted a hamburger, a Minuteman hamburger. He wrote his father, as a matter of fact. And I didn't know how I was going to do it, but fortunately I found an architect, Mr. Ed Cromwell, that was going over there. And he took it over there for me.
Still hot.
Well, no, Mr. Cromwell had to heat it up for him when he got there. Well, I've been in the restaurant business since 1946, one way or another. And I think it was about 1956, latter part of 56, or early 1957, that we really began to go. And that's when we converted what we had into the charcoal broiled hamburger concept.
We've talked food this week. Next week, you've got some parks information for us.
Yeah, I thought we'd just take a little trip around the state and look at the past of some of our state parks. I have a friend who does some work for the Pryor Center, Stuart McClendon out of Little Rock, and he has taken on the mission of taking his children to every state park in Arkansas and has almost completed that. I've forgotten how many there are, but I'll have to look that up before the next show.
I want to say there's maybe 75. No, that's the number of counties.
But I think it's somewhere close to that.
Okay. Well, we'll hear about some of them, not all of them, next time.
I'll have to ask Stuart.
Yeah, there you go. Randy Dixon is with the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History. Put Pryor Center into a search engine and you'll find all about what we talked about and so much more. Randy, thanks as always.
Thank you, Kyle. I'll see you next week.
This is Ozarks at Large. The number 10 in the country Arkansas Razorback women's basketball team, now 10-2 overall and 1-1 in the Southeastern Conference after yesterday afternoon's 91-88 defeat of Missouri. The Arkansas women will next play at Tennessee Thursday night. Meanwhile, the University of Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team lost to Missouri on Saturday afternoon. They will next play at Tennessee Wednesday night. The John Brown University basketball teams have yet to play this year. In fact, they have had games canceled and postponed over the last few days because of COVID-19. The games that were scheduled for today and earlier, January 2nd, were non-conference games. They will not be made up. The game against Langston, which was to be played Saturday, postponed because it is a conference game. No word on when that game or those games for the JBU men and women will be made up. So next on the JBU basketball schedule, a week from today, Monday, January 11th at Central Kansas in McPherson, Kansas. Meanwhile, the UAFS men's basketball team now 1-3. The women are 1-4. Both UAFS squads are idle until Thursday, January 14th and Saturday, January 16th. When both teams will be hosting Texas A&M Commerce University.
What is Pavonis Mons? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager with the U of A Center for Space and Planetary Science. And this is Scratching the Surface. Pavanus Mons, Latin for Peacock Mountain, is a large shield volcano on the planet Mars. It is the middle member and the smallest of the three Tharsis Mountains to the east of Olympus Mons. The volcano was discovered by the Mariner 9 spacecraft in 1971. Now, as a shield volcano, Pavanus Mons has an extremely low lying profile, like that of a shield laying on the ground, and the slope at only a 4-degree incline. Like the other volcanoes in this region on Mars, Pavanus Mons is covered in large amounts of fine-grained dust. Most of the surface consists of volcanic lava flows, containing faulting and very deep grabens into the ground. Because it is the middle member of three Tharsis volcanoes, this gives us a clue as to its formation. It actually may be similar to chain volcanoes, like how some of Hawaii's volcanoes form a chain of fiery geology. This means that Mars may have had localized hot spots where a large chamber of magma would build up, uplift a volcano, then the surface moves slowly to where the magma uplifts a completely different area in a chain, and so on. So Pavanus Mons is certainly a fascinating area on Mars for the purpose of studying volcanics and the Martian Tharsis region. For more on the Center for Space and Planetary Science, spacecenter.uark.edu.
Scratching the Surface with Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto Manager, is produced in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas. You can find more episodes at KUAF.com.
This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Eureka Springs. 91.3 KUAF continues to be a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to this first new edition of our program in 2021 included Antoinette Grajeda, Jacqueline Froelich, Timothy Dennis produced today's show, did yeoman's work to get this show on the air. Thanks again, Timothy, Antoinette, and Jacqueline. And thanks to Daniel Carruth and Susanna Sitek, whose voices you will hear again soon in 2021 on Ozarks at Large. Our appreciation as well to Randy Dixon from the David and Barbara Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History for coming by. Randy will be back with us next Monday. He'll have archives about the state parks of Arkansas. That's on next Monday's edition of Ozarks at Large. And this reminder, you can find out much more about the Pryor Center by just putting Pryor Center into a search engine. Scratching the Surface is produced by Pete Hartman inside the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at the Carver Center for Public Radio in downtown Fayetteville. Scratching the Surface, written and hosted by Dr. Caitlin Ahrens. Our theme is titled First Hurrah. It is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can listen to anything you heard again, anything you heard today on our show again by going to ozarksatlarge.com. There you'll also find past full editions of Ozarks at Large, as well as individual pieces, stories, and interviews that you can listen to or share once again. And don't forget, Ozarks at Large is available as an absolutely free podcast through all of the major podcast distributors. And speaking of podcasts, in 2020, KUAF launched at least 3 new podcasts. You can keep up with them by going to the podcast page at KUAF.com. Thanks again for your continued support through 2020. We look forward to having a great relationship with our listeners again in 2021. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thank you so much for being with us. We will be back with you with another brand new edition of Ozarks at Large tomorrow at noon and 7 on 91.3 KUAF.